Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Ross tells us the stock market followed the U.S. dollar chart. He takes a look at gold and crude. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Market historian Bob Hoy tells us that lower interest rates won't mean a better stock market. He points out if central banks were effective in setting positive economic conditions, we wouldn't have had 18 recessions since the U.S. established the Fed. He also answers the question, is Bitcoin the modern equivalent of tulip mania back in the 1600s? The publisher of thetrendletter.com, Martin Straith, also has a special offer for you. Martin examines raging government debt, the Russell 2000, Bitcoin, and the rising demand for oil from India. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a good way to finish off the week, Jim.
And how did the stock markets finish off the week? Before we get to that, though, Ross, do you have a special offer for our listeners?
Yeah, we're coming down to the tail end, as we've been talking about for the last few weeks here, that, you know, as markets reverse and present opportunities, that's what our technicals are all about. We look for those opportunities to jump out, and we've had a few things really come to life here in the last couple of weeks, the gold market, the Bitcoin, and, you know, clearly some of these AI stocks, and we've had some signals there. So, we're in position now. If the markets decide to have a bit of a correction, which they eventually will, we'll hopefully have some brand new signals for subscribers at that point. So, we're coming down to the point where, this last week will be the end of the discount window. We're going to have 25% off good through the next week, and then just take it easy for a while.
So how was this week in the stock markets?
Well, do you want to start the week and finish it in the middle of the week? you know, it was quite something. It most of this week really related to what was going on in the U.S. dollar. It started to come under pressure a week ago, and 5 or 6 consecutive days on the downside here. We'd been in a trading range. Nothing really big had been happening on the dollar for the last month or so. And it had managed to retrace about 60% of the decline from the October high, but it was just thrashing around. And then the early part of this week started to give up ground on a consistent basis. And so with that, a lot of the items that are priced in dollars took off to the upside, had pretty good run into the Wednesday, Thursday. Some of them reversed on Friday, and the equity market definitely up at the top of the list. You had all-time highs in most of the indices, the NASDAQ, the Dow, and the S&P, but by the end of the week, they were marginally lower. Some rotation going on, though. If you take a look, the Russell 2000 was up about 1% on the week, and but the big winners were the 8% move on the upside in Bitcoin, and also on the GDXJ, the gold mining index, had an 8% week, That's the best that we've seen in there in a long time. And, you know, it comes because of the strength that we've seen in the gold market.
So what happened with the U.S. dollar to affect the markets?
Well, I mean, you got the Fed here in terms of interest rates and, you know, what's going to happen. So at this point, there's this question of, you know, if you're not going to have higher rates, then it doesn't attract the dollar. And it looks like, you know, we've had a nice little rally as far as the bond market is concerned. With that, interest rates have eased off. I mean, the bond market, we've rallied, for what, 117 and a half up to 122 and a half. Pretty good bounce in the bond market and, lower rates. So, that's taken the wind out of the dollar. Percentage-wise, you know, it's only about a 1.5% move on the downside this week in the dollar index. But, you know, it's a change in trend out of this consolidation, or starting a trend in this, out of the consolidation. That always brings up, you know, questions of, you know, what's the Fed going to do, quote unquote, when it comes to rates moving forward here? How close are we to the recession? And, you know, I could care less about that. I just like to read the charts and the chicken scratches there and look for opportunities when they jump out. You know, when you get into trending markets, you get nice corrections that present opportunities. When they become exponential, like we've seen in the AI stocks, then you look for interim highs and corrections on those. It looks as though Friday was one of those days. I mean, the NVIDIA volatility was quite something, 10% swing on the day, and that ranks it up high with, you know, I guess probably second only to what was going on in Supermicro, SMCI. That one on the week up about 26% because it now is included in the S&P 500. So there's a lot of institutions who now feel that they have to own this as part of their repertoire. Everything goes in cycles. And at this point, there is some rotation going on. As I say, the broad indices were down, but you take a look at the Russell 2000, it was up roughly 1% on the week. So, there are things happening there. And when we look at, you know, these moves that we've had in the AI stocks, things have become exponential, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this is the top. If we look back to the dot-com era in 1995 to 2000, there were numerous, volatility points along the way up, and particularly in 1988 and 1999. And, tops take time to develop. They don't usually happen overnight. And if you look at what happened back then, it was a rotational top. The groups of stocks, turned slowly as we moved from January through the spring, and the S&P didn't finally top out until the last week of August in 2000. So, you know, this time around, the model that I have, which works off the 100 years chart on the S&P, it's got upper targets that are pretty close to here. The S&P is roughly 5,200 right now. My targets are in the 54 to 5,600 range, very, very close to here. But, you know, if I look back on the modeling, what you would expect to see is a rolling top that could take the better part of months before things really start to give up the ghost.
Digging deeper into gold, what's going on there?
Well, we had that really nice buy signal here back not too long ago, just under 2,000 back in the middle of February. And the initial move looked for it to test resistance in the 2040 to 2060 range. That one then became a catalyst point for the upside action, and the decline in the U.S. dollar has really helped out here. When we look at the measurements, the depth of this consolidation that we've had since 2022, we get a series of Fibonacci numbers on the upside. The first one was at 21.76, and that was reached as of Friday. The normal action here at this point would be maybe a small consolidation, a little bit of a pullback, but the next upper target that we're looking at is up around 23.50. So there's quite a bit of running room as far as we've got here in gold prices. We do have our first overbought readings on Thursday and Friday, so you know, a consolidation next week would not be out of the cards at all. You know, the look at the miners like the GDXJ, for all that it had a great week, we still have not taken out any key resistance level there. $36, I think, is the level that the investors want to keep an eye on. And over in the silver market, that one has really been a bit of a dog here, has just not participated at all with the gold market. Looking at $26 is the real catalyst point that you need for a breakout. And if you look back at these long-term consolidations, we're talking about the type of thing that we've seen maybe half a dozen times since 1980. For silver to break out through 26, you really need to see the U.S. dollar index break down much more than it has this week. But that's the type of catalyst you need to really get that silver market going. As I say, the upside looks pretty good here. Typically, when we get a combination of our sequential or our springboard signals at the bottom of a trading range, such as it was in gold back in February, the optimum trade is to buy call options that are about with a strike price that are halfway up to the anticipated target. So in this case, the GLD calls for April were really the optimum item for investors to take a look at. Those had just one fantastic week, went from $2 to $12 in this last five or six trading days. So that's the type of thing you want to try and take advantage of. When you get a quiet market or a market that's had a pullback in a trend, you know, you look to take advantage of the pullbacks when they're few and far between. You get maybe half a dozen across the board in a given year, and you want to take advantage of those.
What's happening in the petroleum market?
Everything sort of paused this week. We pulled back. The crude oil market had been in we look at this big 10-year cycle, at this point, we probably are in a stage where you've got no more than maybe another 3 to 6 months of buoyancy. Ideally, we have a small pullback in here. We're around 78 to close off the week, but you know, anything in the mid 70s should be a decent support level with one more seasonal push to the upside. And I think that, you know, that's about it for this run off the December low. So take advantage of a pullback, there are half a dozen stocks that are worth looking at in that group, as well as just the ETF themselves, the XEG or the XLE. The Nat Gas, we've been looking for a good move off the low. It's had its first little push off the bottom, pulling back at the end of the week. But I think there's still some running room as far as that, the gas and the gassy stocks are concerned.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Okay, Jim. Be with you next week.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Bob Hoy, next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He's speaking to us from Vancouver. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Yeah, hi, Jim. It's good to be with you and good to be with our listeners.
We always like to start our show off with listener questions. Our question today comes from Michael. Hello, Bob and Jim. Market Watch headline, investors rush to snap up bonds before the Fed starts cutting rates. Bob, I'm confused. Why would the Fed lower interest rates when they say we are a booming economy? They admit inflation is still way above 2% and that the economy will experience a soft landing. So, Bob, why would they be begging for lower rates?
Well, it's a knee-jerk reaction. No, I've just done a study on it. And interest rates, short-dated rates, such as T-bills or call money, they go up in the boom, and they go down in the bust. So, and I've put charts back ages, you know, I mean a couple hundred years, and interest rates go down in the contraction, and it's just awful, terrible. So, and I note that the Treasury, the six-month Treasury bill rate set its high in the middle of August, and it's sort of downtrending since. Now, in the last few weeks, the Treasury bill rate has gone up a little, but generally it's quite a bit off of how high it was in August. So the next step actually will be the short rates, as defined by Treasury bills, declining, and the Fed will have to follow, and it'll be in the disaster of a full contraction. So, no, I was fascinated to do this study, and rates going down is the bad story. So, we'll see how it goes. And then he was...
Michael goes on to say, you would think we would be running out of foreign governments on the planet to buy all these bonds, and why would investors buy these bonds with inflation running so hot and the stock market's on a tear? Well, why would they?
Yeah, well, actually, the bond market, long treasuries have been all over the place. A huge crash until a couple of months ago, very oversold, and then a rally. And then also the late in the year, the junk bonds got quite overbought, corrected, and are back to being up to that same level again. So now the problem facing interest rates in a post-bubble contraction, which seems to be becoming more inevitable every week, the rates go down. The real rate goes up. The real rate is when you take the nominal rate of interest, for the 10-year, and adjust it for what the rate of inflation is. And so far, the real rates are up by about 3 percentage points, which is, people are complaining about it. But historically, the rise altogether over a few years could be as much as 10 percentage points. That's what it's done in the past, and it's very, very painful. So that's ahead of us, and I don't see anything that's going to offset it. No matter how much the Fed pours money into the system, short rates were doomed to go down anyways. Long rates doomed to go up. So there's a trap ahead of us that's going to be fascinating. I think that as we get further into it and hard times are around, people are going to look at the Fed and say, look, you spent trillions of our tax dollars trying to prevent bad things, and here we are in bad things. So I think eventually the Federal Reserve System is going to come under very careful scrutiny and criticism. So they deserve it, and they deserve to get whacked mightily, because the central banks last year took quite a hit on being too extended in long treasuries. And they're still long. They've still got a lot of bonds, they're long treasuries they're owning. And the long treasuries over the next year or so could be very bad in price as real longer interest rates go up.
And Michael concludes, Bob, some financial clairvoyants see a cloud of red dust in the distance. Could they be seeing a financial mirage or red ink on central bank balance sheets or bond vigilantes approaching fast with pitchforks?
That's very good writing. I like it. Yeah, mirage of red ink on central bank. Yeah, yeah, they're in bad shape. Of course, the bond vigilantes is of course the financial forces marking bond prices down and interest rates up. But I haven't seen the term for a while, the bond vigilantes, and I like it.
And my question is, Bob, central banks, especially in Russia and China, have been buying all the gold they can lay their hands on for the last dozen years. Is that a good move on their part?
Yeah, some central banks have been accumulating gold. And it is, now, I don't know why they're doing it. But for whatever reason they're doing it, it's net the right thing to be doing. Because historically, the reserve in a central bank or even a commercial bank has always been gold. I mean, that's the real stuff. And, yeah, it really works to provide the discipline for central banks when they get a bit reckless. Actually, to keep the gold reserve keeps them disciplined, and this will be a good thing.
Now, the central bankers in Canada and the UK sold off all of their gold quite some time ago. Should they be investing in gold again?
Oh, yeah, they should be accumulating gold, yeah, for sure.
Are they?
I've not seen anything about it in Canada. No.
Well,
no. I think Canada was a patsy on that one. I think it wanted to get into a group of G20 or G7 or something like that. And I think the side deal was is they sell all their gold, and that was back in the 80s when LTCM, Long-Term Capital Management, blew up. I think some of the big people ended up on the short side of gold, and it was rigged to go down. So there was a whole lot of jiggering going on back then, and as part of it, Canada ended up selling all of its gold.
I also remember the screams of anguish from coin collectors when Stephen Harper took the precious coins Canada held, whose face value was not what they were worth as collector's items. They were worth a real fortune, and instead he melted them down to turn them into gold bars.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember that one.
Well, I do, because my sister collects coins.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
Now, some of the headlines that caught Bob's eye this week. Chinese insurers warn of debt risks of property giant Vanke.
Vanke, yeah. I put that one in because now we got a new giant property developer in trouble to follow. Remember there was Evergrande? Was that the one we followed for a while?
Evergrande, yeah. And then the biggest one, Country Garden.
Oh, yeah, Country Garden. That was a wonderful one. So, well, now we've got another one to follow, Vanke.
Yeah, my friend in Hong Kong, Cam McMurtry, has sent me several videos of those artificial cities. I call them artificial because nobody moved there.
Yeah.
Being imploded because they never bothered to put in doors or windows. So the weather just came roaring through those towers. And now they have to be destroyed for safety reasons. They're in danger of collapsing on their own.
Well, they didn't finish them.
No.
And there were clumps of maybe 10 or 12 towers in a clump. And huge towers and very empty. And now, of course, without getting finished, they deteriorate very quickly and they're being torn down. And this is what reminds of the great investor Vanderbilt in New York. The 1873 bubble, the feature of that one was the railroad stocks. Mm. So everybody was building a railroad, and in some cases from nowhere to nowhere. And that's what Vanderbilt observed, and had no business in building railroads that go from nowhere to nowhere. Well, this is where they've been building cities that had nothing in them. So,
well, so much for Field of Dreams. Build it and they will come.
Oh, wasn't that a wonderful movie?
Now, I heard one of the problems with those instant cities was that they forgot to put in institutes of higher learning beyond high school. And the Chinese revere higher education.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if your kids don't have a college or university to go to, why would you move there?
Good point. I didn't see that one, Jim. Yeah.
Headline, China is churning out more EVs faster than everybody else.
Oh, yeah. Electric vehicles. They give people who own and drive them a sense of virtue because it doesn't put carbon dioxide out the tailpipe or other bad things. The problem is, and you use a whole lot of bad things to make the battery. You got to dig up a lot of things. And then the batteries are subject to blowing up from time to time. And then you've got the disposal afterwards. And they're finding that, sometimes just a bit of a dent on the fender changes things enough that they got to throw the whole car away. So, or pickup truck or whatever it is. So the the battery-driven vehicle has been one of the craziest manias in history, and it's probably over, and people are realizing that they are not what they're very expensive and very dangerous, and even the insurance companies are beginning to realize that this is the case for them, so... Yeah, I think the EV story is going to continue to shrink.
Yeah, and an EV is a resource pig, and I've kept this number around. The copper that an electric vehicle uses 183 pounds or 83 Ks. That's 277% more copper than your internal combustion engine car.
Oh yeah,
where's all that copper going to come from?
I'm not against electric vehicles. Yeah. I mean, when it's the battery ones are the problems, because, going back to early 1900s, you had electric streetcars in cities, which were wonderful. And then after World War II, they transformed it all over to electric trolley buses, and that was wonderful. But the craze now is that it has to have a very inefficient battery in it. And that's the problem. I had, the days of trolley buses with wires up top, that was all fine. It all worked wonderfully well. But
Vancouver was smart. They kept their trolley buses when every other city in North America was dumping trolleys for diesels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Headline.
They kept them going for quite a while.
And they still do. Now, this headline comes from Reuters. Corporate junk debt defaults hit post-pandemic high in February.
Yeah.
Bob, you warned us about junk bonds quite some time ago.
Oh, yeah. The world's been buying junk bonds like you wouldn't believe. And it's a very dangerous place to be.
China sets high bar for growth and turns to an old crisis playbook.
Yeah.
What's the old crisis playbook?
I like the Wall Street Journal on this one. Is that the bureaucrats decide, they're going to have this much growth. And then they turn to the old Keynesian recipes and how to obtain that much growth. And the Keynesian notions have never been hooked up into reality anyway. So this is just plain dream world stuff. Yeah.
Could you give an example of that, Bob?
They've done it in the past. The Federal Reserve is the classic example of the government wish machine. Before it was established, the higher-ups knew that a financial crisis would be followed by a recession. So then the proposal was that with the Federal Reserve, there, with the ability to lower interest rates and create credit, that there would be no more recessions. There would be no more crisis. They would be able to prevent the credit crisis that leads to a recession. There's been 18 recessions, cyclical recessions, since the Fed opened its doors for business in Christmas 1913. So it doesn't work. And yet everybody, the whole of the investment community, and as well as the government and everything else, really still believe that the Fed can prevent recessions. And right now they're saying that the Fed cuts will be good because it's going to prevent the recession. And I've done this study that points out that the recessions falling interest rates is a bad thing. Rising interest rates indicate the boom is on, and that's a good thing. Falling interest rates indicate that the boom is over and you're into contraction, and that's a bad thing. So this is where we stand now, and as I mentioned, the 6-month Treasury bill yield is down about 35 basis points since August, and it's recovered a little lately, but it's suggesting that the trend is for market rates of interest is beginning to head down. So it's going to be rather bleak out there. Yeah.
Also, you'll remember Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Well, they've tried 18 times.
That's hasn't worked. Central banking for you. Yeah. That's a really fabulous description. Yep, indeed, yeah. Definition, yep.
Yeah, it must be a true saying, Bob, because it's on a coffee mug of mine. Headline from the Wall Street Journal, the problem isn't big banks, it's banks getting bigger.
Yeah, now, I really admired whoever crafted that headline there, because this is what it is. It's a bank, a commercial bank, becoming huge because it's lending out so much money and its asset base grows tremendously. And then it becomes very dangerous because they're doing reckless banking. And that always gets them into trouble. And then you get to where there's a recession, and then they find that all of their customers can't pay the loans that they took on so eagerly. What's the old saying? Yeah, And then the banks are going to call in the loans. So here you have, it's an old saying that in the good times, the banks are handing out umbrellas. And then in the bad time, when it starts to rain, they call in the umbrellas.
Headline from Reuters, Japan faces reckoning with its zombie companies. Bob, what's a zombie company?
Well, I looked them up, and they were companies that sort of quasi-government companies that were formed decades ago, and they're just sort of there. Nobody knows what to do with them, and I guess they're becoming a bit of a problem. And but I did like the term zombie. Yeah.
Headline from Yahoo, Bitcoin and gold both hitting all-time highs are a jarring contrast for markets.
It's interesting that certainly on gold, it's often played with a very weakening dollar, but the dollar hasn't been particularly weak. So gold is being bid up, and of course I keep track of it in real terms. And the best way is, or a practical way I like, is gold divided by the CRB commodity index. And it's been acting quite well. And this is what gets me into being very bullish about gold stocks. It's because it's being driven by the prices, like the CRB. You can say it represents mining costs. And so long as gold is going up or the CRB is going down relative to gold, then your mining costs are declining and that increases earnings. And the gold investors now are in there, as I recommend it, to invest in a stream of increasing earnings, which is investing. Whereas the old mantra since the 1960s has been dollar down, gold's up. And that's a speculation in foreign exchange markets. So in the real world, the price of commodities is falling relative to gold, which suggests that mining costs are declining. And we know that energy costs are about 60% of running a mine. And so then you take gold divided by crude, as crude representing energy, and it's really up. Maybe gold divided by commodities was up some 28% or something like that, but the gold divided by crude oil was at its best was almost up a double. So this is going on right now, that these mining costs relative to gold have been low since November. So they've had 6 months of where the real price is going up, helping producers now. So their earnings should be increased. It's a positive, let's put it that way.
Now, my question about this, Bob, is Bitcoin like tulip mania? And by way of background for people who don't know, tulips were introduced to Holland in 1593, but the bubble didn't happen until 1634 to 1637, and at the height of tulip mania, one tulip sold for 10,000 guilders, and that was enough money to buy a big mansion on Amsterdam's Grand Canal. Yeah. Is Bitcoin tulip mania?
Yeah, the 1637 tulip mania was driven by novices. The authorities in Antwerp were very concerned about it, but it was outside of their jurisdiction, and they said, you're on your own. because these are not trades that will clear through our system. So it was wild and on its own, run by newbies. And the Bitcoin, would it exist if there wasn't a stock market? I pose you that one. So anyways, it's been a marvelous counter, and one should watch for it getting overbought again, because that would lead to not just a correction in the Bitcoin, but quite likely a correction in the big stock markets as well. Now, on this move lately, our view back in October was that we were going to get one of those fabulous markets out to January. And then when we got to January, it was still looking good, so we thought it would continue maybe into March. And it's now set some technical excesses, so it has now become vulnerable. But I don't know exactly when it's going to break. Often after mid-year is the time when markets can head south for the winter. So all we know is that it's very overbought, extremely expensive stock market, and people should be taking their money off the gaming tables.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, good to be with you, and look forward to next week.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Bob loves to answer your questions, so you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Coming up, Martin Strath, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News, online at thetrendletter.com. Speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC, which is just east of Vancouver. Welcome back to the show, Martin.
Oh, good to be here, Jim. Thanks.
Martin, do you have a special offer for our listeners?
We do. If they go to our website, thetrendletter.com, and right on the front page there, you'll see your House Street logo. And we're going to offer what we offered back at the World Outlook Conference crowd. So 42% to 65% off on, you know, depending what product you pick and whether you bundle anything or not. So that'll be we'll leave that up for the next week.
Stock markets keep rallying, especially on the back of NVIDIA. What do you see going forward?
Yeah, well, stock markets have been rallying, although they're just down about 33% today here Friday. This week we saw the Fed Chair Powell testifying in Congress. So, and there he reiterated that the Fed has stopped, you know, they're done with cutting or raising rates, and that cutting rates will probably happen at some point this year. And of course, the markets love that stuff. So, you know, you got the S&P 500, NASDAQ, the Dow, and globally indexes all over the place hitting all-time highs here. I mean, we even saw the Japanese Nikkei, you know, after 30 some odd years, finally make a new high. So it's interesting, though. One of the things that's really sticking out to me right now is that, you know, the Magnificent Seven stocks, so NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, et cetera, the group that led the, you know, it's been leading the way higher all along here. Well, most of those stocks are now falling off here. We're seeing Apple's down about 15%, was down from its recent highs, had a little bounce today. But it's lost, you know, it's really lost its kind of luster as a, as an innovator. It's not being swept up in this AI craze. You know, Apple's already, you know, break down below its 200-day moving average. It just about tested its key support at about 165. So that's something to really keep an eye on. You know, you've got Microsoft, Google, Tesla, Amazon, all down from their recent high. And it's really only NVIDIA that keeps trucking higher. And, you know, it almost looks like that we're starting to see a bit of a rotation of the kind of the old guard, you know, tech guys. So you're seeing like Apple, you know, with some money from Apple selling off and moving into the new hotshot NVIDIA. And, you know, if you look at NVIDIA, just to see how crazy this is, their market cap is sitting at $2.27 trillion. And that's larger than the Brazil's gross domestic product. And it's closing in on Italy's gross domestic product. So to look at that, you know, NVIDIA's market cap would put it at the ninth largest country in the world based on GDP. You know, in the last 3 years, we've seen NVIDIA's revenue forecast has gone from $25 billion to $60 billion, and now it's well over $100 billion. I mean, this is wild growth and expectations. And, you know, it's that train's running. You sure don't want to get in front of it right now, but it's pretty wild stuff. Now, we're also seeing a rotation into the small caps. You know, the Russell 2000 just hit a new all-time high last week. So, you know, that the small caps were really lagging behind, and now they're starting to pick up. So you're getting a little bit more breadth happening here. Now, in sentiment, like all the leading indicators are showing that, you know, this market is extremely bullish, meaning that it's extremely overbought. So you got to keep an eye on it. Now, other interesting thing happens, you know, Warren Buffett, you know, most people would consider him, you know, probably the greatest investor ever. Well, he's sitting on this massive pile of cash. You know, he's got $160 billion in cash. You know, he's a value investor, and he says he can't find hardly any stocks that he calls attractively priced. So he's sitting on cash and short-term T-bills, and he's looking for a pullback. So, we're seeing the market. It's not selling at these highs. So far, we're seeing that kind of that rotation. So we're seeing a rotation out of, like, Apple. We're seeing it out of the software stock. We're seeing it out of the cloud storage, the cybersecurity, the internet, the social media. Those momentum stocks have been, you know, driving it all up. We're starting to see a bit of a rotation into, you know, oil, gold miners, natural resources, you know, those sectors that were kind of left for dead. So they're starting to get some love here. So, you know, we're due for a really, I'm really looking for a waterfall sell-off in equities coming up here soon. I sort of hope we get that. And if we do, that would be a buying opportunity for us and our subscribers.
You posted on X how the U.S. is now paying over $1 trillion on servicing their debt. That's more than they budgeted for defense spending. At what point does debt become a major problem?
Yeah, isn't that wild? I mean, you know, we've been harping on this stuff for so long, and unfortunately, most people just don't seem to care. They just, you know, they hear government spend, you know. You know, we were just talking earlier about how the Canadian, you know, Arrive Canada app was budgeted for $80,000 and they spent $60 million. It's just crazy. But, you know, you're right. Like these, and it's not just the U.S., it's all kinds of governments are doing the same thing. You know, the U.S. total government debt is now up to $34.5 trillion. Their projected deficit this year is $1.7 trillion. And here's another number. The U.S. is adding $1 trillion of debt every 100 days. And like you said, you know, they're spending $1 trillion a year just to pay the interest on their debt. And I mean, given that they continue to run up these massive deficits, they actually have to borrow the money to pay the interest on their debt. So they're basically, it's like using one credit card to pay off another. So let's look at the numbers. So U.S. national debt, so $34.5 trillion, that works out to $102,500 per person in the U.S., $266,500 per taxpayer in the U.S. Now in Canada, you know, we've got, it's not as bad, but it's pretty bad. Our debt is $1.2 trillion. So for each person, so all of your listeners, all of their family, for every Canadian, Each Canadian, our share is $30,800. The Canadian debt is growing at about $110 million a day, and it's $4.5 million an hour. And, you know, as bad as that all is, it's not going to get better. And, in fact, I think it's going to get worse because you've got an election, U.S. election in the fall, and the big stories I'm hearing is that Trudeau wants to also call in the Canadian election in the fall at the same time. And my concern is that both Trudeau and Biden, I mean, they're both, their numbers aren't looking good. I'm suspecting they're going to kind of look back at what happened in COVID, and they're going to do that, you know, that free basic income for voters. And basically we're going to end up with like a permanent COVID relief package. And that's going to drive up debts massively. And, you know, even voters that know that that's not a good financial idea and it would probably destroy the economy. You know, if you've got one politician running saying, I'm going to pay you $1,500 a month, and the other guy saying, that's crazy, I'm not going to do that, I think a lot of people would vote for the guy giving them free money.
Gold just hit a new high. The last few times you've been on the show, you suggested gold could reach over $3,200 this year. Do you still believe that?
Yeah, you know, gold's just doing this quiet move. You know, it's making these new highs. You know, it's up another $20 today. It's what, 2185, I see. Yeah. So, you know, it's up about 6-7% year to date. So it's doing this kind of slow motion move, which nobody seems to be aware of except, you know, gold bugs and people that are invested in it. Everybody's watching NVIDIA and all the other stuff, and gold's just quietly making these new highs. You know, it, you know, gold bounced around for like 5 years, but now it looks like it's ready to do a big run here. And, you know, you got gold and Bitcoin are trading in really similar patterns here. You know, obviously Bitcoin's a lot more volatile, but they're both starting to suggest to me that I think investors are finally waking up to the fact that, you know, governments are running up these massive debts, and they're just, you know, continuing on as we just talked about. And so I think investors are starting to realize that, you know, their fiat currency, which is just a piece of paper, isn't really worth much. And, you know, if you're going to keep, you know, racking up these massive debts, you're ultimately going to end up with more inflation, and that just eats away at the purchasing power of each one of those dollars. And it's not just the U.S. and it's not just Canada. This is happening everywhere. So, and then the other really big factor in gold's rise is the action from these central banks. You know, we've got last year central banks bought 1,040 tons of gold last year. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, not Canada, the U.S. so much. You're talking about countries like China and Russia and so on, countries that want to get away from the U.S., get away from the West, who don't like the way the U.S. has sort of handled the whole, you know, Russia moving them off the SWIFT system and so on. So China's central bank, they just added in February for the 16th straight month they bought gold. Their bullion now in the Bank of China is up by, 390,000 ounces last month. And they now hold the equivalent of, you know, 2,260 tons of gold. So now you got that, and then you got the, also the benefit of investors betting on the U.S. interest rate cuts going to happen at some point this year. Gold will do well if the interest rates go down. So now, gold's very overbought right here, so I'd be looking for a pullback in order to, you know, add to your position or get into gold. You know, if you're looking at gold stocks, that's been a whole totally different story. You know, they've been brutal. Way lagging behind the bullion. You know, we've got gold stocks have been rallying this week, but I just looked up an hour ago. They're still down about 7% so far this year. At the same time, we got bullion up 6% over the year. And then, you know, it's overbought. So if we can get a nice correction, we'd be looking to add bullion via an exchange-traded fund. So not so much on the miner side, but more on the bullion side. You know, the miners, again, could still join in the rally. But like I say, our next purchase is going to be on the bullion side. Now, you can also buy these ETFs that are leveraged. So you can buy, you know, an ETF that will basically move 2 times the price of gold or 3 times the price of gold. But you have to remember these things work both ways. So, you know, if gold goes up 1%, you know, the two-time leveraged one will go up 2%. The three-time would obviously go up 3%. But then if gold goes down 1%, then the ETFs are going to go down 2% or down 3%. So, you know, I do think that gold's going to have a really good year this year. 3,200, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
What's your take on crypto with Bitcoin hitting record prices?
Yeah, you know, crypto's been wild. You know, it is by far the most polarizing sector. You know, you've got at opposite ends of the spectrum, you've got people who think, you know, crypto is the greatest trading vehicle there is. And then you've got people on the other side, like Jamie Dimon, who calls Bitcoin, you know, a pet rock, you know, implying that it's worthless. And now, just so far this year, you know, we had, you know, the rumor, buy the rumor story with Bitcoin. So when those ETFs were all going, you know, the rumor was they were probably going to get approved. And so, you know, at that point, we saw Bitcoin rack up to about 47,000, 48,000 on the rumor. And then as soon as it got, they got approved, Bitcoin sold off almost 20% to under 40,000. And then, but then, you know, it's spiked right back up. It's spiked up about 70% now. Today, it's sitting at about 68,000. It's just wild. You know, on Wednesday this week, we saw Bitcoin drop 13%, and it's already recovered pretty much all of that in the last couple of days. And here's the thing, Jim. Bitcoin has fallen 13% or more intraday, so within one day, 60 times over the last year, 10 years. And so that's an average of 6 times a year. I mean, that is crazy. So when you get that kind of volatility, I mean, that tells me that both sides, the buyers and the sellers, have a really strong conviction on the, or their particular viewpoint. So what ends up happening? Well, you know, anytime we see a downward movement, the sellers, they pile in, just like we saw on Wednesday. But then right after that, you know, the buyers, they all could jump in on every dip. They consider every dip a gift. They jump in and they buy every pullback. And so far, it's the bulls that are keep on winning. You know, for every heartbreaking, wrenching decline, there's always, it always comes back. So, you know, with these ETFs now, I think there's 13 of them. It's now really easy for the average investor to get in and to buy Bitcoin or buy, you know, Ethereum. It's not ETF yet. They're holding off on that one right now. But more and more, we're going to see more of these ETFs come out. And, you know, with all the uncertainty in governments and all these, you know, these incredible debts and deficits, I think you're going to see, you know, Bitcoin be much like gold and become more of a safe haven play. And, you know, with gold stocks not performing well, you know, buying, you know, these crypto ETFs is a really easy way for both retail and industrial investors to get into the market. So I expect the volatility is certainly going to continue. And to me, it always seems to keep going up. So buying a dip makes a lot of sense.
Last month, you said you were looking for uranium and uranium stocks to pull back, and they have. Are you a buyer here?
Yeah. I think when I was last on, uranium was trading around $100, and it had just dropped down from about 106. And now it's sitting about 93.50. You know, that was the initial support that when I was speaking at the World Outlook Conference, that was an initial target we picked. So yeah, so short term, we just recently did add a new position there, and we will add more if we see it pull back even further. You know, bottom line, nuclear power has a lot of stuff going for it. It's, you know, it's stable, reliable. I mean, nuclear plants, they run 24/7. It doesn't matter what the weather is. They don't need wind. They don't care about whether it's sunny or not. Low greenhouse gas emission. Public sentiment is really turning. Even the environmentalists have realized that, you know, nuclear power certainly has a play here. You know, I think I mentioned on your show last time, you had the COP28 meeting. There were 20 countries, Canada, U.S. included. They did that declaration to triple nuclear energy. So they see that nuclear really has a place here. Technological advances, you know, France's, their newest reactors, they are recycling up to 90-95% of their spent fuel, so dramatically reducing radioactive waste. You know, you got these new plants coming on. You know, there's 60 plants under construction. There's 110, I think it is, planned around the world. You know, you currently got 430 some odd. So, you know, and if that tripled, you know, triple the nuclear energy, if they're going to really do that, That would be massive amount of nuclear, and that would require a massive amount of uranium. And, you know, we've had those, you know, Cameco had some issues. Kazakhstan, their main supplier, is having some issues. So I think you're going to end up with uranium prices. I mean, it's pulling back here now, which is great, gives everybody an opportunity to get back in. But I think we're going to certainly shoot, I would say, you know, the record was, you know, way back in the day, 2007, I think we got up to 140, 147. I certainly think we're going to have that again.
What's your outlook for oil and gas?
Oil's been on a real skid. It went from like October to December where, you know, it was up to 95 in October, and it fell all the way back down to 68 in December. Oil's had a really rough time breaking through the 78 resistance level. You know, from early November to late February, it tried six different times to break through 78. And every time it got to 78, it failed and it fell back down. But now, in the last couple of weeks, it's finally been able to push through there. So now what we're seeing is that we're above 78. Now it's actually just dropped below that today a little bit. But I think if we can get around that 78 support level can hold, we could have a really nice run here. We're kind of targeted for $85 to $90. Now, we bought some oil back almost a year ago when it was down to that very strong support level around 66 to 68. So we bought those. We sold a bunch of it partway through, took some profits. And now those stocks have been starting to rally up again. Just back in December, we added an oil ETF. So that was a pure play on the price of oil when oil was, I think, $70. So that trade's worked out really well. So I think that, you know, things are looking pretty good. Now, if you look at seasonality, we are right now, you know, we're just at that spot where oil has its best season of the year. So it usually runs here from, you know, mid-February into the end of June. So we're right on oil's sweet spot. I mean, certainly there's so many geopolitical things and, you know, supply and demand certainly drive this. But based on seasonality, we're certainly in a good spot for oil. So, you know, if you can see this pattern continue, we could see these energy stocks and that oil ETF do really well. Now, if we look at longer term, if you look on the demand side, we've got growing demand, especially in these emerging markets. You know, India, 14% of their 1.4 billion people do not have electricity. You know, the International Energy Agency, just a week or so ago, they produced a report. They're saying that India is going to overtake China in the next 2 years and become the biggest driver of global demand for oil. And you have to remember, too, it's not just India. You know, there's a billion people in the world that don't have electricity. Now, we keep hearing from the COP28 crowd and all these others that tell us, you know, we don't need oil anymore because we're all going to be driving EVs by, you know, 2035. And they seem to forget that oil is such a key component of so many parts of our everyday life. I mean, oil is a big component of our, you know, our clothing, smartphones, construction material, computers, shoes, medical supplies. I mean, the tires for those EV cars have a big oil component. You know, the asphalt roads that these cars are going to be driving on, well, oil. You know, so these are all things that we continue to need. And now you can have all these emerging markets, these countries that are growing, those people want this stuff too. So the need for oil is not going away. And then on the supply side, so we got this, you know, we got this growing demand. And then on the supply side, we have a lack of investment. You know, capital expenditures are down 30, 40 year low. Rig counts continue to decline. And why is that? Well, you've got, you know, the COP28 crowd. You've got governments globally telling us we don't need or want fossil fuels. So they discourage, you know, any investment in it. You know, they've increased windfall taxes. They increase regulations. They allow no new permitting. So you just combine that. I mean, a five-year-old with a calculator could just say, you know, supply demand here. You increase demand and you globally have an effort to squeeze the supply, you're going to have a huge supply problem in a few years. So, you know, we expect to see oil, $100 for sure, $150 or higher over the next few years. Now, natural gas, a little bit different story there. You know, natural gas is so incredibly volatile, heavily affected by weather and geopolitical events. You know, back with COVID, you know, oil was down, or natural gas was down to about $1.50. And then, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. The price skyrocketed up to almost $10. And then we had this oversupply, mild winters. And now, you know, we saw natural gas drop, you know, from that $9.50 all the way back down to $1.50 again. Now, currently, natural gas has rallied a little bit. It got up to just under $2. But now it's pulling back a bit, so we're sitting at about $1.83 today. Now, again, based on seasonality, starting right about now, starting early March, we typically see natural gas's best seasonal period, and we typically see nice run into mid-June. Now, again, seasonality, that's kind of washes over a 20-year average, so certainly any one year could be quite different. But if we could get another cold front, hopefully we could see natural gas spike up to $3 or so.
What do you see ahead for the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, you know, with currencies, I always say this, it's really all about the U.S. dollar. So if the U.S. dollar is strong, then that negatively affects, you know, all the other currencies, and that includes, you know, commodity prices, equities, and precious metals. And then the inverse of that, obviously, is that the U.S. dollar is weak, then all those things start to rally. Well, this week, the U.S. dollar is getting smashed here. It's getting crushed because investors are really anticipating this expectation of Fed rate cut sometime at the end, you know, sometime this year. So at the start of the year, you know, the markets were looking for 6+ Fed rate cut. Now they're talking maybe 3. So the markets believe, this is the big point, the markets believe that the Fed is going to cut before the ECB does. We totally disagree with that. Longer term, we think the U.S. economy is much stronger than most others, and that would mean the U.S. dollar is going to be stronger. You know, it's not that we like the U.S. dollar or we think the U.S. dollar is great. It's the least ugly house on the block. So 2024, you know, it's going to be a wild year. This is going to be a roller coaster ride up and down here. We've got 64 countries having an election this year, and so far in the last year, almost every election, the ruling government, so whoever was in power, got the boot. So you're going to expect a lot of civil unrest happening. And then, of course, we got a U.S. election, and that's going to be an absolute gong show. And I don't care which party wins, there's going to be civil unrest here. You know, they are so polarized that nobody's going to believe the results, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be ugly. So if you get civil unrest, which we expect to see, capital is going to flow out, you know, into the U.S. dollar, and that's going to be for safety. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, that if there's big problems in the U.S., but it's going to trickle around the world. And whenever there's, you know, whenever there's perceived risk, the U.S. dollar is where everybody goes to. So I think it's really important that investors understand how all these things are connected here. So near-term resistance to the U.S. dollar is 104.2. Support is about 102. The U.S. dollar is getting oversold here, so I think we should see a support kick in the next week or so. And then the Canadian dollar, well, like I say, it's all connected to the U.S. So since late December, the Canadian has been trending lower right up until March. But with this U.S. dollar weakness, the Canadian dollar, the loonie saw a spike higher here. So in this last week, the loonies really jumped. But we do expect, you know, the Canadian economy is in much worse shape than the U.S. economy. So we expect logically then that the Bank of Canada will cut rates before the Fed does. And if they do, well, then the Canadian dollar is going to fall in value compared to the U.S. dollar. So Canadian dollar right now is trading at 74.13. Key resistance is at 75.80. Near-term support is 73.25. Long-term, I think that we're going to see the Canadian dollar drop to below 70 cents in the next year.
What about the euro and yen?
Well, the euro, I mean, the euro is basically, it's almost a perfect inverse relationship to the U.S. dollar. So interesting report actually I saw today, the ECB policymakers, they're overwhelmingly backing a June rate cut. And what the report was showing is a bunch of these people are wanting to also do a July cut. So that, you know, potentially means we could have back-to-back rate cuts in Europe. Well, the point to me there is that European economies are weaker than the U.S. I do expect that the ECB will cut before the U.S. does. And if they do, well, then the euro will drop and the U.S. dollar will be higher. I mean, it's just really that simple. I mean, it really depends which central bank cuts first. If the ECB cuts first, the euro is going to drop. If the Fed cuts first, then the dollar will drop. Now, if you look at the yen, that's quite a different story here. Very interesting. I mean, I'm sure I've mentioned this on your show last time. You know, while all the other central banks have been aggressively raising rates to fight inflation, we've got Japan that did nothing. So the U.S. Fed rate is, you know, got up to 5.5%. Canada, Bank of Canada is at 5%. You know, Bank of Japan's central bank rate is still at minus 0.10%. So capital has fled the Japanese yen. You know, there's no point holding the yen. They want to seek yields elsewhere. So for many months, there's been a lot of expectation that the Bank of Japan would intervene and they would raise rates to give the yen a boost, but they have frustrated traders by not doing anything. So from mid-early November right up until the end of December, you know, the yen was rising quite nicely because all of this expectation of the Bank of Japan, you know, stepping in, but they did nothing. So when the Bank of Japan failed to do anything, you know, since January 1st, all the way up until last week, the yen has fallen all the way back to its 35-year low. Now, this week, the optimism's back, and the U.S. dollar's down, but the optimism is back. I mean, reading all these articles, that people are starting to think that, you know, the Bank of Japan is now finally going to actually step in, and they're going to remove their dovish stance, and they're going to start to raise rates to at least 0%. So there's all those little individual stories. But in the big picture, for all of these currencies, Jim, I see the U.S. dollar being that least ugly currency. I see that Europe, I see Japan, I see Canada. I think all those economies are in much worse shape than the U.S. So ultimately, I see the U.S. being the strongest currency over the next couple of years.
You have three services, Trend Letter, Trend Technical Trader, and Trend Disruptors. Can you tell us a bit about each one and how listeners can get information on those services?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Trend Letter, so we're starting actually March. We started in March 2020, so this is our 23rd year we've been publishing that. So that's for long-term investors wanting to understand what drives these markets. You know, we cover, you know, equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities and bonds, and we publish it every Sunday night. So, you know, it's not like once a month thing like a lot of these services. It's every week, and it covers all of those sectors. Trend Technical Trader, now that's for active and long-term investors, started as a hedging service, but now does long plays as well. Again, covers equities, precious metals, commodities, and it includes our proprietary Trend Technical Indicator. And then the third service, Trend Disruptors. Now that's for speculators with risk capital available. Now this service invests in disruptive ideas. So, you know, obviously artificial intelligence, virtual and augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things, all of that cool stuff. So those are the three services. We also have a free service. So it's called Headlines. And what we do there is every weekday morning, We go out and we look at all the news that's happening in the market, and then we send out headlines that we think every investor needs to be aware of. And all the readers can do is they simply can read the headline, or if they want to actually read the whole, get all the details of that story, then they just click on the link and then they can read the actual article. Yeah. So describe to any of that stuff, just go to the trendletter.com. I think I mentioned at the beginning, there's that icon of the House Street, and we'll put those specials up there for a week.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, my pleasure, Jim. Have a great weekend.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He was speaking to us from Coquitlam, BC. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Bob Hoy, and Martin Straith. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.